Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at FreeStyleLibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at FreeStyleLibre.us.
Hello and welcome to the Dear Love Joy podcast. It is a special. Today we'll be having a conversation with June Serpong about her book, Diversify. I really like June. I think I've known her for years because we've been knocking about in the industry. She's a really nice person. She's a great broadcaster as well. And I bought her what I thought was a special present. But I don't know. I can never judge whether people are just, you know, humouring me. I bought her a bottle of olive oil. It sounds terrible, doesn't it?
It was a very nice bottle. It was a very nice present to me. It was very thoughtful. I just wish, you know, and we've done 40-odd of these. I haven't had one.
No.
I haven't had any presents. You've been given wine and sausages and olive oil and all these sorts of things and books.
Yeah.
And what have I had, eh? What have I had?
Love. I'll give you love. I'll give you a hug if you want at the end of this. You want a hug? You don't want a hug, do you? I can tell. It's interesting though, because having worked on Sunday brunch, you realise that there's certain things that you taste, but you would never buy yourself, like a really expensive bottle. It was like a perfume bottle of olive oil.
It wasn't that small. It was like.
Go on then. What's the size of it? Honey bottle.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe more like a hot sauce bottle or like.
Vinegar.
Vinegar.
It's like vinegar, but it was in a box and it was all sort of done. Like that. But if you do taste quality olive oil, it is unbelievable. But it's not something you're ever going to buy yourself, are you? I don't buy myself that. Do you buy yourself that?
No.
She's written this book, Diversify. And, the work she's put into it is absolutely phenomenal. We discussed this in the podcast. It took her a couple of years to write. She talks about it with a lot of passion. Thorough is how she's gone through all the subjects. She hasn't left any stone unturned, and she's done her research as well. She also talks about her career in broadcasting, which I like. I like talking to fellow broadcasters about our career and how we worked it all out, so that's good. Anything you need to talk about?
No, but just her, the way she described her parents and her aspirational parents is very funny. She's very good at telling that story.
Okay, I agree with you totally. All right, let's listen to it. Here's June Serpong.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, write into Dear Love Joy.
Hi June, welcome to my kitchen. How are you?
I'm good. It's so nice to be in your gorgeous kitchen.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Did you decorate this yourself?
Well, not myself personally, but I had someone do it for me. It's sort of my ideas in
very
a way.
Very impressive.
So thank you very much. Well,
now
all the guests we have on the show, we like to buy a present. I wanted to buy something different for you.
Okay.
And I know you like your cooking.
Yeah.
So do you know what? We had a guy on Sunday brunch once who taught us about the beauty of quality olive oil. And no one ever does that. No one ever treats themselves to good quality olive oil. So I bought you this.
Yeah!
It's good quality olive oil.
Amazing.
Now what you do with it is up to you, but I wouldn't cook chips in it. But
no.
it makes all the difference. But
this is beautiful.
It's a nice bottle as well.
My
isn't it?
Olive tree. Gorgeous. Yeah. Well, this is perfect for salad, right?
Yeah, well, they're definitely dressings and things like that. When you taste it, I'm just going to show you here, because this expert can show. What you have to do is you've got to put it in and go... slurp it. Get some air in it.
Bring it on.
So,
thank you.
Pleasure. Where are you living at the moment then, June? Are you here or States?
I'm here. I live in North London. I'm hanging with the cool kids. I love it.
Because you've been in the States for a while, haven't you?
I have. I was in America for 8.5 years. But I've been back now for like... a year and a half, 2 years.
Whereabouts in the States were you living?
First, I was in LA in West Hollywood for 4 years, and then I was in Gramercy in New York for 4.5.
Oh, you did both coasts?
Mm, yeah.
What were you doing out there?
So I had a show with, do you know who Jesse Ventura is?
Mm.
Do you?
No.
Okay, so he's the reason why Donald Trump exists. So he was a wrestler and then became the governor of Minnesota. Only in America is that possible.
Yeah.
And so I did a show with him for 7 years. And then I also had a women's conference there. And then I did a lot of commentary work, like punditry stuff on MSNBC and places like that. So that was fun.
Commentary on what sort of things?
Like politics. And.
Could you see Trump coming then? Could you see that happening?
No, no. I only saw Trump coming when he actually won.
I was in the States after he won.
Could you see him?
No, not at all. But Piers Morgan came on my show and said, he's going to win this. And we were like, what? And he went, no, he will. And then afterwards, I was in Miami and I was staying in a posh hotel, as you do. And I got bored, so I kept going to the deli because the food was cheaper and nicer. And everyone I met in the deli, I said, what do you think of Trump?
They loved
but only because they hated the establishment so much. Yeah. That they wanted something different. Yeah. And I think that's what it was. It was a vote for something different.
It was,
But I don't know enough about American politics or not.
No, but I think you're spot on.
What about Women Inspiration Enterprise? Yeah. That's something you're involved in. What's that?
WIE. So that I set up when I was in America. It's a women's network. It started out as a conference. And it was really fun. It was a funny story. So when I first moved to America, so in that way that British people, sort of expats, tend to sort of congregate. So when you move to America or anywhere, you end up hanging out with British people that you normally would never hang out with in the UK. And so I was in New York I was invited to a very posh dinner, talking about posh events. And lots of people were there. And somehow we ended up standing up to say we'd do a conference. And we did. And the difference in America is you get support from really important people quite quickly.
Right.
So we were very lucky. So we had everybody from Melinda Gates, Queen Rania, you name it. And it just took off from there.
And how did you start by becoming political in the first place? Because have you been political all your life?
Yeah, I think so. Even when I did T4, I was really political. You know, I grew up in a council estate in East London, and my parents were immigrants. We had to flee Ghana because of a coup. And I think when something like that happens to you, it makes you political whether you like it or not. And I've always just been fascinated by politics because I think there's lots of things that I don't know anything about, and it doesn't matter because it doesn't affect my life. Like, I know nothing about race car driving. Doesn't matter. Whatever Lewis Hamilton does doesn't impact me, but what Theresa May does. So
I grew up in a family where the grandparents very sort of working class grandparents, council estate, postman and dinner lady, and they didn't stop talking about politics at the dinner table. My parents were desperately trying to become middle class, you know. So it was just really interesting that that's all my life was talking politics. So I've always been interested. But when you're in the media, it's tough to cross over because don't they go,
what do you think?
You're a TV presenter. Yes. Stick to what you know. Yes. Isn't that what happened?
Totally. And that's what still happens. But I don't care, because the way I see it is that's the problem with politics. It's unfortunately an exclusive domain of a very elite few. And that's why so many people don't feel connected to it. So I get that all the time. I still get that. Like, what do you know? What would you know? But who cares?
Yeah, and you're for some reason thought of as ill-educated on the subject because you're a TV presenter.
Exactly.
What does she know?
Yeah.
Stick her back in her box. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about this book. It's called Diversity and... Diversify. Six Degrees of Integration. Because the world is separate enough. Mm-hmm. This is a huge book. I've been reading through it. This must have taken forever to write.
It did. It's 2 years in total. So it took a year to write, but the research at Oxford was a year before. So 2 years in total.
Okay, give us.
I've had no life in that time. Can you see I'm grey? Yeah, I'm catching up with you.
Thank you, June.
But you look good.
Thank you.
You look distinguished with your grey. No, you do. You know you do.
So the book, you can tell the amount of work you've put into it. Tell us about the book and then explain why you decided to do it.
Yeah, sure. So the book is basically the social, moral and economic argument for diversity and why diversity is good for society. And what made me decide to write it is a few years ago, as you know, I was living in America, and like all British talent, wanting to crack America. And I say, I didn't crack America. I made a small dent in her East and West Coast. And so one day I was filming in Las Vegas and there was this young kid on set who was covered head to toe in tattoos. And it was the funniest thing to him. I felt really uncomfortable around him. And if I'm honest, nervous, intimidated and scared. And it's not as if I'm not used to men like this. You know, like I said, I grew up on a council estate. So back where I grew up, I would have been totally fine with him. But I wasn't used to someone like him on set. And even though I've been a real sort of active campaigner of saying we need more diversity in TV and all of this stuff, malarkey, when the status quo was challenged, even I had to adjust. And in that moment, I thought, my goodness, how hard is it going to be for this kid to make it if even I feel uncomfortable around him? So I'm glad to say I went and spoke to him and he'd had a difficult life, but our sound man had taken him on as an apprentice. And he was so excited about the prospect of a career in TV. And I thought, my goodness, this is what it is. This is what otherizing is. You know, as a woman of color, I've always looked at this issue from being on the receiving end as opposed to actually doing it. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, wow, that's what it is. When you meet somebody who appears to be different and for whatever reason you feel uncomfortable around that person and therefore it influences the way you behave towards that person. And so I thought I'd love to somehow start a conversation around it, but didn't know what. And this was pre-Trump, pre-Brexit. And so I sort of put it to one side. And then Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In book that she wrote came out. And a friend of mine who's a literary agent called me up and she said, you know what, June, I think you should do the multicultural Lean In. And I said, well, it's funny because this incident happened to me and it's been bothering me for such a long time because it's not who I thought I was. And I really want to somehow talk about it. And so she said, well, why don't you write about it? And that's how the book happened.
But this guy, he came to you, didn't he, really? Because if you'd... the two heroes in that story, well, three are you. The guy who actually gave him the job as an apprentice, but also the guy for actually wanting to put himself in that position in the first place. Because if you'd met him in the street, you probably would have... quite rightly gone, I don't really want to engage with that, with that guy. But you do owe me because I read you, I tell you why you owe me, because I read your book and then some bloke came and sat next to me the other day on the station and he was a bit drunk and he was disheveled. And I thought, I read June's book, I'll talk to him. Got on the train and I was talking to him and he was going, if I'm honest with you, he was going, are we in Miami? And I'm going, no. You're in Gunnersbury. I said you want to get the Piccadilly line to Heathrow, if that's what you want to do. Anyway, so I carried on talking to it, and the guy kept on going, "You're a handsome man, aren't you?" And I said, "Thank you very much."
Did he recognise
you? No, I don't think so. He was a bit, I don't, drunk. I after 15 minutes, I had to go, mate. Honestly, I've tried my hardest, but you've got to leave me alone now. I'm diversifying so much, but it was funny. But you stuck it in my mind because normally I'm very British and gone, no, I'm not doing that. Yeah. But actually, by this time we got on the district line. Everyone was listening. Everyone was laughing because I was entertaining him and he was sweet. And I went, I can't do this anymore because you're not talking sense. So it amused everyone. So June, you are right. You are right, Anna.
To a degree.
To a degree.
That's a genius story.
Your fault. What, after living in America and living in Britain, because you've decided to take on both countries, which is huge. We are different though, aren't we?
We're very different, yeah.
What is the difference? I feel like in Britain we mix more. Is that true?
Yes, totally. So I think what we do really well here is... how we integrate on an interpersonal level. So we're friends with people from different backgrounds. We intermarry much more. On that level, I think we are way ahead of the rest of the world, actually, not just America, the rest of the world. But what America does better is opportunity. And I think when you look at, some of the information that came out recently from the government in terms of where people from working class backgrounds are in this country, people from ethnic minorities are in this country, and then obviously if we look at disability, that's a whole nother level altogether. We are really behind. It's bad. It's bad. And I think the difference is because of our class system, and because our class system is so entrenched, we don't know how to create a sort of progression pipeline for anybody who isn't from an elite background. We don't know how to do it, and we're uncomfortable with it. And it's back to you. So it's like what you were saying about people saying, oh, you're a TV presenter, what would you know? It's also, well, you're from such and such, what would you know? There's a real kind of you should stay in your place. And I think as a result of that, that's why we don't have those sort of amazing uber sort of success stories that you have in America here.
It's really interesting because one of the best interviews I've ever done was Vidal Sassoon. And he started life as a barra boy. Yeah. And he went to the great hairdresser Ramon, I think it was. And Ramon said, you can't work here, you don't speak well.
Yeah.
But he decided he wanted world domination. So rather than go, you take me for who I am, he realised in Britain you can't do that. And got elocution lessons. Not only did he learn how to speak properly, he learned tone as well, which is very important. I could do with some lessons on that. And seriously. And then he ended up world domination, but he had to do that. But he mentioned that in this interview so far, we've been going whatever 10 minutes and we've mentioned class a lot. It's a real problem for Britain, isn't it, class? Why do you think we're so obsessed with it?
Well, I think because for a long time, and I say this not to in any way condone it, but for a long time, it sort of worked, didn't it? In the sense that people knew their place and most people were happy with that. You know, most people were fine. You know, a lot of people that I grew up with don't particularly want to live in Chelsea and they don't particularly want to send their kids to Eton. They were quite happy with that. And that's because our economy had jobs for that. So we had jobs that were clearly for working class people. We had jobs that were clearly for middle class people. And then we had, you know, the aristocracy and all that comes with.
Yeah.
And that's no longer the case. So the problem now is we have a system that has been designed for an old way of being and the new way of being doesn't allow for it. So we have to change whether we like it or not.
But I think as the public, we like to stay in our... Because I've said for the last 20 years, I refuse to acknowledge your classes and then I'm on here discussing it with you. But for... People seem to like their class as well. This seems to be a problem. And they use it also as an insult. Being on TV, obviously, I get a lot of insults on Twitter and stuff. Often I'm told I'm posh or I'm told I'm working class. It's like, you know, I'm also told I'm a Tory boy and lefty socialist media. I'm told everything, but, you know, you get it. But people use all these things as insults constantly against each other. And the class thing is used. I don't know why America doesn't have that, no?
Not in the same way. American money is what they value. So wealth is class for them. Are you wealthy or are you not? That's what they value. But I think I don't mind people liking their class. There's no problem with that. But I think what we now need to make sure is we have equal opportunity. So whereas before, certain opportunities have not been available for people from working class backgrounds, that has to change because those jobs are no longer available. So we need to make sure that we train people and upskill them for the jobs of the future.
You start your book talking about Martin Luther King.
Mm.
I had a dream speech. I decided to go on YouTube and actually watch it because, you know, when's the time that you actually watch that speech? You know, you probably did it for the book and I just thought I'd go back. It's an amazing speech, isn't it?
Amazing. He just timeless.
But he keeps repeating, I have a dream. And it's like he hammers that home. You make the point that he might not be happy with the world it is now if he was still alive.
No,
you
not
think
at all.
Not integrated enough, but we have integrated more than it was back then.
Oh, for sure we have, no question. But I think what we haven't done, Tim, is have the conversations so that we can deal with this stuff honestly. Because what happens is it's beneath the surface. We're also uncomfortable talking about it. And therefore, resentment brews. And then you have things like Brexit or you have all of these sort of shock results like Trump because we've never really spoken about this stuff honestly.
Well, you think as a population when Britain or America this is or both we're still not discussing the issues enough.
Not at all.
You say you've experienced being excluded because of sex and color. being a white male, I've sort of got the keys, really.
Yeah, you've got the keys. Being a posh white male.
Not all white men.
And then I'm quite clear in that.
Yeah, you do actually. Yeah, you do. But being a white male, explain what excluded means, because I think so many of us just
don't know what it means.
Yeah, we don't actually appreciate it enough, I think.
I love that. How wonderful. I love that you were able to articulate that. Okay, so an example will be... if you are a privileged white man, so it's not all white men, a privileged white man, if you don't succeed at something or you don't get something in life, you never have to question if it's because you're a privileged white man, by and large. It's usually because maybe you weren't right for it, maybe you weren't whatever. For anybody else who isn't that, most of the time, the reason they didn't get the thing is because of their otherness. So if you are, and I would say a privileged, able-bodied white man. So if you are a disabled person and you go for a job and you don't get that job, you will question whether or not your disability played a role in you not getting that job. Mm. If you are a person of colour or you are a woman, again, you will question if that had an impact. And if you look at things like the sort of pay disparity, if you look at who we value in society, immediately we value privileged white men above everybody else. And the number one thing that we use to quantify value in our society is money. So therefore, if we want to know who we value in society, let's look at how much we're paying those people. That tells you everything we need to know.
Do you know what really shocked me? We work in media together, and all my bosses are women at the moment, and they have been for quite a long time. Mm. The woman who commissioned me, the woman who runs my production company, my exec producer, women. And I think it's we're quite equal in that. Mm. But then when the BBC announced their wages... do you know what? I was so shocked that someone on the same level, someone on the same sofa was getting paid more because they're a man than a woman. That really did shock me, especially the BBC, that would still happen. And then you've got to do the wake up and go, oh, hold on a second.
What are we doing?
It still is like this, if it's even in the media, which, you know, we're quite... we're lefty,
liberal,
aren't we?
Yeah. lefty lovey.
Yeah. So if there's going to be equality, it's going to be in the BBC.
No.
So that, I mean, I found that.
I wasn't shocked by it at all.
Weren't you?
No, I don't think any woman was shocked. And I don't think any person of colour was shocked. And I don't think any working class person was shocked. Because also, if you look at that list, 45% of, if you look at the top earners, actually, the majority of them were private school educated as well. So it's actually, it's even deeper than just gender. It's also class, if you really look at that list. So I think...
It did. When I first worked in TV, there was a thing where people used to sit around and talk about what schools they went to. And I did find that really...
Connell School for Girls.
I went to St Clement's Day, a comprehensive school in Chorley Wood. But it doesn't, you know, to me, it didn't matter. Mm. They were doing it. But I'd never been in an environment when people discussed their schools. We were all like, you know, no one went, what school did you go to when we going out and about? It was quite a strange thing. It was a new world I'd gone into. But I didn't hate them. They're all very talented people. So
neither do I. And also, hello, any break I've gotten in life has been... from mostly privileged white men. So so this is not in any way male bashing in any way, shape or form. This is just about saying, I think that we are wasting so much talent in not levelling the playing field.
And you're opening your eyes to people like me who would have looked at the BBC thing and gone, wow, because I'm in the industry. You're going, look, let me show you it through the whole of society and how it's working. So what is the point of the book then? What are you trying to achieve by doing it, apart from opening my eyes?
And darling, apart from opening your eyes, which is the most important thing, of course. I think the point of the book is really just to start conversations. And to make people aware of what it feels like to be other, whatever that other is, and also to help connect people with the other too. And I think it's when people connect, it's when friendships are formed, it's when you have that sort of honest exchange that the magic happens, you know? I use my cousin Reg as an example. You know, when my aunt came over from Ghana, And her husband couldn't afford to come with her, so she came first. And then he came later. So she was a single mum for, you know, 2 or 3 years with her child. And she was a cleaner. And it was a white working class family who took her on under their wing and sort of made her their daughter, as it were, and co-raised my cousin with her for the rest of his life. And this beautiful bond happened between these two families who on the surface would look like they'd have nothing in common. And so for me, it's about how do you create those connections? Because I believe we're all missing out.
All right. See, I like that. I like the idea that your book is a pro book, not an anti book.
Oh, it's a pro book.
Because I think pro movements have a lot more power than anti movements. By going, you're a terrible person because this is happening.
No way.
Is not as good as saying, look at what these lot did, and look how beautiful their relationship has turned out. Mm. It's a big vision, isn't it, you're trying to create in this. And I quite like the idea also you're appealing to our wallets.
Yes.
You talk about the economics.
Yes, yeah. Because I think that's what, you know, unfortunately, rightly or wrongly, that is what we value most in society, if we're honest.
You know,
we value money over people. We do. And I think whatever you think about Brexit, what Brexit has to be is an opportunity to do things differently. And I think that the communities that have been ignored and forgotten now need to be retrained. We're not going to be able to get talent from other countries in the way that we have done in the past. So therefore, we need to make sure that we prepare the people that we've got here for those jobs. And so I think there's a lot of talent that's wasted. When I think of the girls and the guys that I grew up with, I wasn't any more talented than them. I was lucky in that I had aspirational parents. And then I was given an opportunity at a really young age, which completely changed the trajectory of my life. And I think actually the people that I grew up with, there's so much talent there that as a society we've never been able to experience because they've never been given that opportunity.
So much has got to do with what's happening at home, don't you think?
Yeah.
Talk about it earlier. My mum was such a powerful woman. She was any more than my dad often. And she went out and became a saleswoman in the new computer age and stuff and started doing stuff like that. And so I saw women, and actually my best friend's mum was really as well powerful woman. She was really far women to live type thing and had signs everywhere in our house stuff. So I saw women as being quite powerful. So when I was employed by women, I never saw it as a problem.
Okay.
So I just see that. My daughters, as you know, you've met them. Mm. I can't imagine them going into the world without thinking they're equal.
Yeah.
And so it's a lot, you know, I think there's a lot to do with what you're teaching at home. You say you've got aspirational parents. That must have helped you a lot.
Totally. My parents, I mean, our family, we were in Ghana, we were part of the elite. We were very wealthy. And we were all supposed to be raised in Ghana. We were born here, but the idea was we'd move back and we'd stay there. And then the coup happened, and so we ended up back in the UK with nothing and in a council estate. And so the difference, I suppose, for my family was they were educated and they were aspirational. And so therefore that was sort of drummed into all of us, that we were expected to succeed. So, you know, our report cards, we didn't get a pat on the back when you brought home a B. No.
Really?
What is this nonsense? So.
Wow, you had pressure there.
You know, so I had like all these, because also the thing with my school was like the good state school. So my sort of middle class do-gooder friends whose parents didn't want to send them to private school, sent them to our school. So we had kids from all walks of life there. And so my sort of nice middle class friends, their parents would hug them and kiss them for getting a C and, you know, well done for trying, Poppy. And my mum would be like, what is this rubbish? Come back with an A. So yeah.
How do they feel about you now, though? They must be so proud. You've made it all the way to America, setting up, you know, the women's inspirational enterprise, etc., etc.
Well, it's funny because so when I first got the job at Kiss FM, so I was supposed to go to university, and I got the job at Kiss when I was, I don't know, 18 or whatever it was, and I decided I was going to go and work at KISS and not go to university. I said, you know, the whole point you go to university is to get a job, and I've been given the job that I want to do. I'm going to do the job. And my mother went mad. And so she called a family meeting. All these aunts and uncles flew in from Ghana. My dad was there. Everybody was there. She's like, she's bringing shame on us. We did not come to Britain for her not to go to university. And so
that's amazing.
It's a shame. And so my dad said, I'm going to give you a year. And if this nonsense doesn't work, you're going to university. So anyway, so I thought, oh, I better make it work. So luckily, then KISS literally put me on air within a year. And so once I was on air, then my mum was like, oh, yes, I told her, follow your dreams. Listen to June. She's on Saturday morning at 10 a.m. on KISS FM. And so,
oh, that's brilliant.
And so now she's happy. But yeah.
How did you get on air then? Just
you know what? I mean, actually, I want to hear how you did it too, because I don't know what your start was, but mine was, it was just amazing because KISS had just become legal then. It had been legal for a year. And they didn't really have any money. So they would literally put the post girl on air. That's how it was. And so I was on this thing called the record inquiry line. So it was like a receptionist. And they were like, oh, do you want to start doing some ads? So I started doing some ads. And it was like, actually, do you want to start doing the news on a Saturday? And then it was like, oh, actually, let's get you on a show properly. And that's how it happened. It was amazing. I mean, that would never happen now. It was just, yeah. How did you start?
Well, I was just going around. I made a decision I wanted to be on TV. I was going around just doing work and making show reels of myself. But in those days, you had to hire a cameraman and a sound man because you couldn't do it on your phone or anything, you know. And then you had to do it, and I'd just send them out. And then I got a job behind the camera and ended up working on The Big Breakfast. I used to work a lot for free and then at night do bar work to pay for it all. So it's not a sob story or anything, but I didn't go on holiday for years. I just was desperate to work in TV. But
you were at Planet?
Yeah, yeah. But I was lucky, the explosion of TV, like the explosion of radio happened with you. The explosion of TV happened. They needed people. So I was promoted up very quickly, and then people at Sky found out I could present as well, and I ended up just getting a job there and doing Soccer AM.
Of course, yeah.
Took a bit of a pay cut to do it, but I loved it, you know. But it's the same. I remember KISS and all that lot coming along. They suddenly, all the pirate stations got their licenses and suddenly they needed staff, but I had no money.
Yeah.
So it was a really good opportunity
such
for everyone.
Such a good opportunity. Such a lovely, exciting time. It's such a shame there isn't that anymore for the new generation. It means YouTube. But it's not the same. You don't get the same training.
Well, it's a weird time in TV because you know, you're on T4 as well, which was an amazing place for discovering talent.
It was.
Now there's no T4 either. Or is there T4 maybe online or something? But
no,
it's not like it isn't there.
No.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But now there's no T4. Where does the young talent come from? All you lot on MTV as well.
Yes.
You did MTV.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's so much talent came through there.
SMTV. There was so many. What was the show that Reggie and Holly did on BBC?
Oh, I can't remember.
That show, yeah, like there is nothing like that anymore. So sad.
Well, you say sad, at least it means no competition for our jobs.
Means our subconscious still get to work.
Yeah, we're still getting, you know, we don't need any more presenters out there.
We don't.
I'm getting older. Let's get back to your book.
Yeah.
Because I keep saying you put a lot of work into it, because there's a website connected to it as well, which I recommend people going onto it, because I was on there last night. You've put a lot of knowledge on there as well, a lot of facts and figures, and there's a test you can take. I got 10%.
Oh,
is that
you're
bad?
Good. No,
is that
that's
bad?
Brilliant.
Oh, I was worried about that.
No, that means
10%.
You're like, you literally have hardly any isms.
Yeah, but we work in media, so it's hard to have them, I think.
So I bet your isms were around sort of politics or something. I bet you were one of those.
No, the one, no? You think it was the one where if your child married
a Labour person or a Tory person,
would you be offended? I wouldn't at all.
No, you wouldn't.
Because I really believe you've got to look at everybody's side of what's happening, listen to their opinions, which is kind of what you say in the book.
Mm-hmm.
All right, but you also, with every chapter, and I'll go through a few of the chapters in a minute,
please.
But with every chapter you did research. And who did you research with, and what sort of things did you do?
So I teamed up with Nuffield College at Oxford University with their research team. And they really are. They're one of the best sociology departments in the world and on this stuff. And what I said to them is, look, I'm not an academic. I want you to condense this information in a way that I can understand it. And if I can understand it, that means the majority of people can understand it. So they kept sending stuff through and I'm like, what does this mean? I'm like, what does this mean? Like, oh, no, this isn't going to work. Go back. And so they just condensed it down into really simple charts which allows the reader to see where we are on all of the different other groups. And, you know, when you see some of those statistics, when you see, like, for me, I think the thing that shocked me the most are the stats around disability. So, you know, 1 in 5 people in this country has a disability. It's like almost 12 million people. And when you see that, and 80% of them were not born that way, so this could happen to anybody, could happen to any of us at any time, and you see just how underutilized the disabled community is. So there's over 1 million disabled people looking for work who can't find work because they're discriminated against because of their disability. And you have 1.4 million disabled people who have learning disabilities, and only 6% of them are in work. We would never accept that of any other group. We just wouldn't, but yet we're comfortable throwing away people because they don't fit our idea of the ideal body or the ideal mind. And I think that that for me was more shocking than any of the other groups.
There's, when you read through it, it can get quite
depressing.
Yeah,
no, but there's hope. It's hopeful, there is, though.
The one bit which I quite liked, and this is terrible, is when you do comparisons between us and America. We're usually quite good.
In
all that sort of stuff. I think America's got a lot more problems than us.
Yeah, way more.
But there's certain things, like one which I dug out, which really just shocked me a lot. Mm. 1 in 10, the proportion of gay and bisexual men aged between 60 and 19 who had attempted to take their own life in the past year. Mm. I found that really shocking, that still we've got legalized gay weddings now and everything, but they still feel for some reason that they don't fit in.
Yeah, I think we don't understand because, again, because we're in media and it's so acceptable in the industry that we're in, we somehow think that that's the rest of society. It's not. If you're a gay man in finance, if you're a gay man in tech, like if you're a gay man in construction or sports, think of the pressure of that.
I've always found the sport thing really weird.
I've worked on it for
years. But
how many out footballers are there? How many out football managers?
See, I'm split by this because I don't think it's anybody's business.
It's nobody's business, but you should be able to be who you are 100%. Without fear of rejection.
But the problem is, you say you're gay, then the papers. I mean, the papers start going gay footballer.
Exactly.
It's like, what?
What? In 2017?
When the gay rugby, there was a gay footballer who came out. I can't remember any of their names. And there was a gay rugby player, Gareth. I can't think of his name. It'll come to me in a minute. When he came out, I couldn't believe all the headlines written about it. It's like, does it matter?
Does it matter in 2017?
But again, I think we've got a false impression of it because we work in the media.
Yeah. And because it's just so commonplace in our industry.
Yeah.
It's so normal to us. But that's definitely not the way. And also think, if you're a young girl or boy in a little village somewhere and you're having to come out to your parents, you're in a very masculine community or a community that has very clear ideas of what femininity is, and you go against that grain, it's tough.
So what is things like the Oxford Oxford University, you also wrote to prison cellmates, didn't you, to find out why they were in prison and
so again, I was really interested in, you get, you know, when you look at sort of our prison population and why it's disproportionately filled with men from ethnic communities and low-income communities, in the same way that our elite professions are disproportionately filled by men from privileged communities. So what I say is, I think the wonderful thing about inequality is it shows us what works and what doesn't work. So we know what works. We know what works. Good education early on in life, then, you know, good higher education, and then a network that's around to help promote you in whatever career you go into. We know what doesn't work: bad education, family breakdown, so on, so on, so on. And I think if we just do more of what works for everybody else, we will address a lot of these issues. And so, yeah, that's what I wanted to write, you know, get actually a sort of first-hand account from men who haven't been so fortunate in life.
Is there ever a stage in the writing process but you thought, I've bitten off more than I can chew? Because you're just looking at
it's a lot of work. Luckily it was over a long period of time. I mean, do you know what I did think? I'll be honest with you though, Tim. it is a lot of work, and I'm not in a rush to write another one. Like, I'm like, please, yeah. I'll do a picture book next. Like, I mean, it's a lot of work. And I suppose it's like a baby, you know, like sort of 7 months in, you know you're near the finish line, but there's still two more months to go, and it's like agony. But I just was so passionate about it and loved the process, so that made it worth it.
And you got to, and you had to get your facts right, didn't you, really? Yeah. Otherwise this book doesn't work.
Oh, it doesn't work, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you talk about the others. Is that something you've invented, or is that a terminology that people use?
Well, I think it's a terminology that's sort of around, but I want it to become much more commonplace. And I think I don't like words like racism. I think it's too harsh. I think racism is, you know, the people that we saw at the Charlottesville protest flying Nazi flags and, you know, chanting death to anybody who isn't, you know, whatever. That yeah. is what I consider racism. I think most people, otherwise, most people are somewhere in the middle, which is you just feel more comfortable with something that seems familiar to you. And so what I hope that this can do is just to, you know, challenge some of that otherizing.
So you
think, and we're all guilty of it, myself included.
Well, you said at the beginning. So you think when people are classing someone as racist, it might be just, I want to stay with what I know.
Yeah, and I don't like that word. I mean, I think that word is used far too easily to describe behavior that is not racist behavior.
And also people decide what other people are like
yeah.
based on them. The otherism,
exactly.
And I'm going to do that with you now because you said something interesting earlier, and I want to pick up on it. I assume you vote Remain, but you said Brexit's all right.
No. I'm on the board of the Remain campaign.
Oh right,
I'm Remainer all the way.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. But then you said we've kind of got there, so let's use it as a
yes.
Okay,
yeah.
So
I'm a Remainer. I don't want Brexit in any way, shape, or form. But what I'm saying is, if it's going to happen, let's make sure that we decide the kind of country we want to create post-Brexit.
That's no, really wise.
I don't want Brexit.
How many people are saying that at the moment? They're not. They're just still sitting on, I don't want to get involved
in Brexit.
Because I do believe that people should have the right to say, no, we want another vote, because they're so angry about it. But if it is going to happen, let's try and create what we want.
Exactly.
You know?
Let's try and make this madness work.
Let's look over the waters at Finland and go, do you know what? They've reformed a lot of their stuff. Why can't we do a bit of that? It's true. That's how I feel. So let's go through some of the others then. The other man,
mm-hmm.
that's disenfranchised males yeah. in society, black, Muslim and white working class men.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got you've done a chapter on all of these.
Yeah.
And these are the people, the others. Mm-hmm. Other women.
Women in general.
Okay. The other class.
That's class.
Okay. The other sex.
Which is LGBTQ.
Okay. The other body.
Disability.
The other age.
I think age is another big one, in that we place such a disproportionate value on people that are of working age. You know, we sort of don't have much value for the young, and we sort of throw away the old. If you're not paying taxes in our society, we don't really value your opinion in the same way.
I think throughout time, young people and old people have clashed. That's a real problem.
Mm.
They've got different ideas about the world.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's getting worse at the moment, or has it just always been this way?
I think it's getting worse, because I think there was a time when we valued our elders much more. You know, grandparents and great-grandparents were such a part of the family unit. And were considered as vital as parents. Now we've got such a focus on the nuclear family. And actually, I don't think that's enough. I think it's a lot of pressure to just put on two people or one person. I think you do need a village to raise a child. You know, when I think of my godchildren, for them, certain things it's easier to talk to me about than even to their parents. So I do think we need to value our elders much more. And one of the examples I use in the book is in Holland, there's a big intergenerational living scheme that has students living in old people's homes. And it's great because it sort of tackles the issue of high rents for young people, but then it also tackles the issue of loneliness amongst the elderly. And it's great, you know, these youngsters forming friends with these old people, and they're sitting there talking about sex all day. I mean, it's amazing.
I love it when my mum's here and my daughters come over, and
lovely.
But when they have a discussion with each other, they've got such different ideas on the world. Yeah. You know, my mum was in the war, and so she always brings that up. Mm-hmm. Always tries to trump us with, "Well, you've not been in a war.
You're like,
well,
yes.
Well, not a world war like she went through. Yeah, but
still,
you know,
time, mum. Yeah.
And it's so fascinating though, seeing them, because they're 15 now. They're bright, so they've got opinions, but they're so far removed from my mum's. And then you see the age gap there. It is quite an amazing thing to watch.
Yeah.
How we get that closer, I don't know, because they're miles apart in their opinions.
They're miles apart, but I suppose it's realizing the value that each brings to the other. So, you know, for your daughters, I bet they keep your mum in tune with what's going on in terms of how technology is changing. You know, they probably, you know, make her laugh and makeup or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then for them, there's that sort of wisdom that they can get from your mum without the sort of pushback that they might have against their own mum or against you as a dad. You know what I mean? So it's a really lovely, I think it's such an important component in raising kids.
I did a documentary on sharing mum and dad, being divorced, wanting to look after my children. As soon as I went through the process, and a lot of men will recognise, as soon as you go through the process of being divorced, you're suddenly treated a bit like a criminal with your children. I found it, and I had pretty good divorce, and I've got, you know, amazing contact with my children, 50-50. But I found that I was treated as second-class citizen. So I started making a documentary about it. And what I found more than anything was that we're still stuck in the legal system and everything. We're still stuck in women look after children, men work.
Yeah.
And every time I was for ages, I was going, we need to have legislation against this. And eventually it became, the whole documentary became about children's rights, because it's more about children's rights to get a loving parents.
Yeah.
However, what I did find fascinating about the whole thing was legislation I didn't think would work. It's got to be a shift in opinions and attitudes. So as soon as, because in Scandinavia, and I hate to go back to that part of the world, even though I don't think
we always have to, don't we?
But in Scandinavia, men and women are expected to look after the children and expected to work.
Yeah.
And my Scandinavian friends said, you know, I don't want to have an education. These are women. Mm. I don't want to have an education and then not use it. I want to, you know, and everyone wants that sort of equality, but still in Britain, judges, the law, and also a lot of British people, including some of my family, who said to me, "Don't do this documentary, Tim, people will hate you."
Did they?
No, why? Because people like their roles. And it did occur to me that actually maybe people do find comfort in the gender roles, and maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think you're right, because I think you're the first generation of men that have challenged the sort of gender sort of status quo, as it were, in that I'm sure you're much more hands-on with your kids than perhaps your father was with you. And I know in my generation, the same, because it wasn't expected of men then. And so I think it's so important what you did in sort of shining a light on that, in that we still have a long way to go. And also because our, you know, justice system is not fair where men are concerned and childcare is concerned, no question. And I think actually it's really important that there are men like you who are in prominent positions shining a light on this, because at the end of the day, 52% of marriages now end in divorce.
Yeah.
That means the majority of men who have children are going to go through the process that you're describing.
But I think we also need, if we get equality in the family is an important thing to have for equality in the workplace.
Totally. Because it starts in the family.
Because if you're an employer and you look at, you've got a man and a woman and you're in Scandinavia, you go, I don't know who's going to take paternity leave here. Because in Sweden, they started equal paternity leave in 1974 or something. I mean, it's ridiculously long time ago. And if you go, well, I don't know which one, I'll employ the best one or the one that I want to work with or whatever. But if you're in this country still,
penalise the woman.
You still might go, that one, I'm not.
How old is she?
Yeah, do I spend money on training? Do I, you know, and we know he's going to work. I know I can make him work.
Yeah.
because he doesn't have to go and look after children or do the school runs.
Yeah.
Employers are changing dramatically now and having to get in that position. And I'm lucky because of my job, I can be flexible enough to look after my children. So I've been very lucky. But it's an interesting thing that we need to look at it. And having my...
Is it different with the new baby? Has it changed in terms of...
Not really. I think it's still similar that I think we're stuck in it. Like our class system, I think we're stuck in... And I say, the big question I ask myself, because I talk a lot about it, and then I torture myself a bit sometimes by going, am I wrong?
No.
I do sometimes think, are we comfortable with our gender roles and I should just butt out and this is not the right way to go?
No, but I think there's nothing wrong with being comfortable with our gender roles either. So I have nothing against women who want to stay at home and raise children and men who want to work. There's nothing wrong with that. What we're saying is we need to allow for flexibility for people that want both. That's
all. But there will be people screaming now at this going, I just want a woman to do women's and work and men to do what's wrong with it. It's traditional and it's what we do.
People
know their place. That's what people
should be able to choose for themselves. That's what we're saying.
Yeah.
I don't mind if someone wants to do that, but I think we should also allow for someone who doesn't want to only do that.
Yeah. Okay. It's a bit of a minefield, isn't it? Because you are trying to change attitudes all the time. And I think that's the big thing. We'll get to that in a minute because that's really what your book's about, isn't it? Which is good. Right, so the other age we did, then the other view, what does that mean?
Yeah, the other view is basically what we were talking about earlier, which is allowing for different viewpoints. You know, most of us, particularly with social media now, sort of sit in our sort of echo chambers and our sort of silos and bubbles, and we only follow people who think the way we do. I know I've been guilty of that. You know, I'll look at Nigel Farage's feed and be like, you know what, I can't rule with this anymore. So I think it's really important to make sure that you understand the other view. And it's only when you really understand it that you can debate it properly anyway, because you need to know where somebody's coming from and how they've arrived at that viewpoint.
Yeah, so it's easier for me to talk about America than anywhere else but I think the Trump thing's the prime example of that, isn't it? It's like you sit there going, I can't believe Donald Trump is president of the United States of America. But you've got to say that. That's the question. Why? What are people saying?
Yes.
Why do they feel this way? That's what you're saying.
Yeah, and why were they so exhilarated by Trump saying the things that they haven't been allowed to say for so long? So, you know, when Trump came down those escalators and accused Mexicans of being rapists and goodness knows what else he said, you know, most sort of PC people like us were like, oh my goodness, oh, he's finished, he doesn't have a chance. Not knowing there was a whole slew of Americans who were like, yes, we've been thinking this and we've not been allowed to say it. He's speaking for us. And so I think it's really important to understand why people think the things they do.
So the other way in action, what does that mean?
The other way in action is how society could be if things were a little fairer, a little more inclusive, and a little more balanced. And you know, in terms of modern civilization, we've never really had an example of it. So what does that look like? Because a lot of the time we're saying, oh, we want this, we want that, but we don't even have an idea of what this or that is. And so what the other way in action does, and it's the final chapter in the book, is presents a vision of what maybe that could be. You know, what could that be if anybody, regardless of their background, is able to contribute to the best of their ability?
And you do that by discussion.
I think you do that by discussion first, but then there needs to be action, because discussion only gets you so far. If we don't actually start acting upon this stuff and legislating on this stuff, then it doesn't change in a sustainable way. So you need both.
But we need to open the discussions about everything.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I don't want to talk too much about my views here and stuff, but I think
I want to talk about your views.
it's about you, but I think the conversation thing's really important. Mm. I really do. You know, I think rather than, so you mentioned Nigel Farage there, rather than slamming him all the time, why do you feel this way, Nigel?
Yeah.
Why is it that you don't feel like the rest of us? And then you can understand,
understand
why he feels the way he feels, and then you can agree with it if you want to.
If you want to or not. Yeah, and also then you can empathize with it because you sort of understand how that person arrived at that viewpoint. What were the things that happened to them in life that would make them think this way? And is there anything you can learn from it? You know, there may be something in, you may disagree with 90%, 95% of what he says, but there may be some jewels in there that we can cherry pick and say, actually, this bit makes sense. So I think it is really important to have those conversations. And often we never want to hear anyone who thinks differently.
Yeah, we're all a product of our childhood, I imagine, in our brains and what happens and the way we think and our society and everything else. And I suppose everyone's got, the people are going to listen to us talking now and go, they are talking nonsense. Aren't they? People are going to
course, doesn't everyone?
Yeah. But, you know, there you go. We had Adam Rutherford on our podcast the other day. He's a genealogist. Well, he's a political writer now, and he's written some interesting books. He wrote a book about genes. He said something that I love, so I'm going to share it with you.
Yeah.
I've just got to find it. He said, because genetically we're all very similar as humans. He said, conflict is with people, not biology. And I thought that was really interesting because that's the sort of political thing that you touch upon a lot in this and in your book. It's not about biology, it's about picking differences in people. Because biological, we're all very similar.
Same, yeah. Like, biologically, we are the same, 99.9%, so yeah.
Let's talk about age in the media, just quickly. We touched upon it a bit earlier on. How do you feel? I feel like I'm getting coming to the end of my days.
No such luck.
But one thing I'm really conscious of is I'm a man, and I'm very rarely, people say I'm ugly and I'm getting old and all that sort of stuff, but my performance is very rarely judged on my looks.
Yeah.
However, every time I work with women, they are judged on their looks more than what they say, always. Mm. And it's often by other women as well, as well as men.
Yes,
So, you know. Are you conscious of that being in the media?
Do you know what? I want to start a different conversation around age. So I turned 40 this year and I love it. I think I'm so excited to be at this phase in my life because I have a certain level of confidence I definitely didn't have at 30 and certainly didn't have at 20. And I think we're doing age differently, our generation. You know, I think I like the idea of getting older, particularly if you're still healthy.
Yeah.
So I think as women in particular, we have to change the conversation and own our age. You know, when you see a woman who owns her age, you can't help but be impressed by that or even attracted to that. You know, if you look at a Helen Mirren or whatever, there's this, or a Susan Sarandon, you know, these women who are in their 60s and 70s and just owning every part of that. So I personally think as women in media in particular, we need to change that dialogue.
Yeah, but it's not just down to you, is it? It's also down to the your employers, and they do seem to... We do live in a world where...
Ageist society.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do. But I do think it's not down to you. You can't control what someone else is going to do, but you can control what you're going to do. So you've got two choices. You can either be really sort of neurotic and insecure about something you can do nothing about. We're like, George Clooney said it, and I thought it was brilliant. He said, well, what's the alternative?
Yeah.
The alternative is you're not here. If you don't want to age anymore, the alternative is, well, you're not on this planet anymore. And so I think, you know, there's not much you can do about aging. So enjoy it. Enjoy the process.
He's going to be president, isn't he, one day? Don't you think, Clooney?
He could do.
He's gearing up.
I think he is. I love his wife.
Oh, yeah, she's great, isn't she? But don't you think they're gearing up, the couple of them? They're going to
Well, Trump can do it. Blooming hell.
But it's like kind of the Reagan thing all over again, isn't it? And having a first lady like that, it all sort of works, doesn't it?
Yeah, it works.
I'm voting, but I'm not American.
Yeah,
but
I'm voting.
So what else are you up to, June?
Yes, so I have a show on Sky News called The Pledge, which is lots of fun.
I like that.
Oh, do you?
Yeah,
I watch
it.
Oh, nice.
I like debate. And what I like about that debate is you all seem to get on afterwards, even though you've got very different opinions.
Yeah, we really like each other. Yeah, it's such a fun show to do. Yeah, I love it. So that's really cool. I just finished a show on art. So we'll be looking to do that next year as well. And then, yeah, we're going to make a documentary out of the book. And that's it.
A documentary as well?
Mm. Yes. So we're going to make a documentary out of the book. So we'll do that next year. I'm working with Catherine Round. She's an amazing doc maker.
I've got to say the website, by the way, I didn't mention it, yes. diversified.org. It's a good way. Take the quiz. I got 10%. I'm gutted that I got 10%.
No, but
I was But I was really honest.
I'll
tell you afterwards the bits I did, but yeah. I was honest with it.
Good.
Maybe too honest, because I know I could have cheated and got 0%.
No, but 10% is really good.
Is it?
Yeah. I mean, my God, if most people were 10%, we'd have the best world ever.
Yeah, I'm a media lovely though, so... All right, we ask every guest who comes on the same question, so I'm going to ask you this. What advice were you given that has been invaluable to your life? Someone's given you some advice, what is it?
Yes, I was given some amazing advice by Margaret McDonough, which was...
Who's Margaret McDonough?
She's a politician, she's right. Amazing, really fabulous woman. And she basically said, and I think because she helped Tony Blair win all of his elections, and she said... never give up, because your time will come at some point. So sometimes it's just a timing thing, you know, sometimes it's just not your moment. So just hanging on in there until it's your moment.
Very good. Is there a piece of advice that you would like to give our listeners that you know that you'd like to give them?
Yes. If you want to give up smoking, just don't put a cigarette in your mouth.
That's my one.
I thought I'd borrow it too. I think it's really good advice, and I think it applies to everything.
Yeah.
You know, anything you don't want to do, don't do
it anymore.
Don't
do it. Yeah. Just stop doing it. I know everyone laughs, but that was one of the really I stopped smoking 16 years ago.
Profound information.
And it was one of the things which helped me. What mistake do most people make? Maybe doing your job in media, or maybe something else. Do you know anything?
I think driving. I think most people are really bad drivers.
Do you?
Yeah.
And they think they're good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I admit I'm a bad driver.
Are you a bad driver?
Well, I'm a safe driver. But I'm terrible at parking, like really bad at parking. And I'm probably annoying to drive behind.
Have you got any life hacks?
What's a life hack?
A life hack is like if you don't want to ever smoke again.
Yeah, that's my life hack. My life hack is if you want to give up smoking, do not put a
cigarette
in your mouth.
That's good. That's good. You don't smoke, do you?
No.
Good. Okay, I like this one. What's it like to be famous?
Well, it's funny. I'd say my fame has changed over the years. I think when I was younger, I was a lot more famous. It's nice in the sense that people know you, and so people come up and say hi to you. That's nice, isn't it? And then it's... not nice when people know you and they don't like you. Mm. So yeah, I think it's like going to a party where most people in the room know you and there are a few in there who can't stand you.
Well, you're at the height of your fame. Was that probably T4
time? Yeah, that whole era. Because I suppose in the same with you, we were a voice of a generation, weren't we? So there was a generation that completely grew up.
Well,
you
were. I was stuck on satellite TV. I'd like, you know, all the football fans and stuff.
Yeah,
that was kind of cool.
Gotcha.
But you crossed over to everyone, didn't you? There was a stage where you walked down the street, everyone would know you, wouldn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, there was a stage, yeah. And I was very young at the time. But yeah, I think it was fun in the sense that I suppose... the show was such a fun show that people associated us with enjoyment. So that was by and large a response that we got. So, yeah.
Did it ever take over, though, your life at all, where you were sort of thinking, this is a bit too much? Did you ever doubt who you were or worry about it?
No, not at all. No.
And you've dealt with it by doing what you want to do. Mm. All right, another question that I've just recently added to the list, and it's becoming quite popular, so I'm going to do it with you.
Yeah.
June, what is the meaning of life?
Oh, God.
Good luck.
I don't have a bloody clue. That's the meaning of life. I have no idea. I think we're all figuring it out, aren't we?
Yeah, That's why I keep asking people.
Yeah. No idea.
One day someone...
No, I tell you what.
Hold on. We've got it.
No, it's not mine. But there's a really cool guy called Daniel Pink. And so I'm going to promote someone else's book other than mine. And it's called Drive, Why We Do What We Do, or something like that. Anyways, Daniel Pink Drive. Yeah. I'd recommend anyone reads it. And he asks two questions. And the first question is, were you better today than you were yesterday?
Yeah.
So we should all be trying to improve ourselves.
Is that just mentally or physically?
Just as a human being. Who are you in the
world? All round package.
Right. Were you better today than you were yesterday?
Okay.
And then the other question was, what do you want your life sentence to be? And I don't mean jail time. As in, when you are gone, what do you want to be remembered for? And if you know what that is, then that should sort of govern the decisions that you make in your life.
That's good.
It's a really good book. I'd recommend it.
I like that. And do you think you're ever going to get into politics, as in...
You know, you're not going to believe this, Tim. You are the third person that's asked me this in 2 days. And they're like, do you want to be an MP? Definitely not.
Because
I think I like the idea of being able to do stuff like this. I like the idea of being able to sort of have conversations where you can be truly honest. And also, you know, I have a lot of MP friends. That job is a thankless job. It's hard work. No.
It is, but you could potentially go all the way, couldn't you? You know, if you're thinking that, yeah. I'd love the look she's giving me at the moment is absolutely brilliant. You could... That was brilliant. Like, you don't have to just be an MP. You could actually go to leader of the party.
You could, God, no, in the cabinet.
You could do it.
No, why not? No.
Come on, you're ambitious. Your dad taught you.
I'm ambitious, no question. But no. I think there's other things to do. I'd like to lobby. I'd really like to lobby.
Well, when I entered into politics a bit when I was doing the Sharing Mum and Dad documentary and stuff, when I started talking about father's rights, which I must say ended up with children's rights, but yes. Father's rights stuff. I started talking to politicians and meeting MPs and stuff, and I realised there's a lot of power game.
Yes.
It's quite a I don't want to get into it now, but it's quite a complex thing, isn't it? And I think everyone gets into politics for the right reasons, generally, but then it changes into a bit of a power shift and a bit of a power game. So
it's like what you were doing with your campaign. There's loads of ways to influence and bring about change. You don't have to be a member, you know, you don't have to be an MP to do that. I don't think so.
Yeah, you're right. You are right. Now, if people want to follow you, what are you on Twitter?
Yes, and I'm so late to the game on Twitter. I've only been tweeting for a year and I wish I'd started earlier because I love it. I don't do Insta. I'm at June Sarpong.
You should do Insta as well.
It's too much for me.
Is
it? I can only cope with so much.
All right. And your website is...
junesarpong.com, but rather go to diversify.org.
It's worth going on there. And your book's out now.
Yes, Tim, thank you so much, honey. So good to see you.
Good to see you too. Thanks
a
lot.
Thanks for having me in your
kitchen. The book is called Diversify and the website is diversify.org. Get yourself on there. You can take the online test and see what you like with isms.
That was a joy, wasn't it? I really enjoyed that.
I really enjoyed that, but I really like June. So she's a good person.
You didn't tell me you were bothering drunk people on trains.
Oh no, yeah, that was funny.
Like, did he like get up and go, oh Jesus, this is a really annoying sober guy came on.
No, it started on the platform, and then he started saying to me, "I want to go to Miami," and then the conversation. Conversation carried on, and genuinely, started reading June's book. So I thought, well, I'm just going to, you know, I agree with her. I'm going to try and talk to him. And then he started off by having an American accent, which went. And I was just sort of having a bit of fun with him, and I walked on the train. And as we got on the train, so I've been talking to him for maybe 5 minutes, something like that. No, maybe 3-4 minutes. That's all. I walked on the train, and I went, well, listen, mate, nice to talk to you. I'm going to go now. So, you know, it's one of the trains which doesn't have the doors now. It's one of the hollow ones.
Oh, okay, yeah, right? Yeah, yeah.
So I walked all the way along. I walked about 2 or 3 carriages, sat down, found a seat, sat down. And then he walked over and then went, sorry, if I stand here. Okay. All right. And he stood there and he just stood in front of me and the train was going now, so I couldn't really understand him. And he was just babbling on about me being a good looking guy and how I've got lots of, he was being lovely, but he was going, yeah, see, I'm not like you and all this sort of stuff, even though he was actually a young, good looking guy. And it was just funny in the end. I was trying to engage with him. And I just went, mate, you really got to leave me alone now. I've had enough.
During the interview, you came across as a good guy. I think you've just
why?
You've blown out. You told him to go away.
Oh, well, actually, in fairness, I went away. I got up and walked off because I couldn't deal with that anymore. It's like, I was trying to listen
to... This doesn't make you sound great.
Why? I was listening to a podcast.
Which one?
Ours. No, I don't know. I've no idea.
You get your phone out and it's got a picture of your face on it.
Mate, I'm trying to listen to my podcast. And I tried my hardest to embrace him, Mark, so you can't have a go for me for that. I was being one of life's good guys. And then after a while, alcohol, no good comes of being really drunk on a train on a Friday afternoon, and this is what this guy was. Anyway, that's it for this week's podcast. We will be back on Monday with more of the same stuff. Make sure you subscribe to us because you're going to get all the Monday ones and you're also going to get all the specials if you subscribe. You won't miss one. Make sure you give us a mark, score us 5, and you can leave comments or you can tweet us at Tim Lovejoy or you can email us dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. We'll see you on Monday. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at FreeStyleLibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at FreeStyleLibre.us.